So he woke in a dark wood, meaning he came to the realization when he was 35 years old that he was spiritually lost, i.e. in a dark wood. And he was lost because he'd wandered from the path, from the true path, which would be the path of righteousness. Right? Is that clear enough? The second one is, I think most people got, it's from Virgil's Aeneid, and it's the moment when the first blank is Dido and the second blank is Trojans. You didn't need to know that, but it's the moment when Dido and Aeneas meet in the cave and first begin their love affair. And Dido takes it much more seriously than Aeneas, because Aeneas knows he's got a task which requires him to move on and found Rome, even though he doesn't know how to do that yet. Dido, however, is a little overly eager for him, because she's in a very vulnerable position as a woman queen of Carthage, with suitors surrounding her and a lot of pressure on her. So she has sex before she thinks through what she's actually doing, and she tells lies to herself, convincing herself that she's actually married, and convincing herself that she has a commitment from Aeneas, when in fact he has not made any commitment at all. Although you could argue he's a bit of a rat, because any guy knows what a woman's thinking usually when they're having an affair, that she's probably committing herself more than he is himself. Right? The third one is a passage from the Satyricon by Petronius, and one of the answers said it very well. This shows us life around the time the New Testament was composed, life in decadent Rome, illustrating the point that good manners and morals don't necessarily go along with wealth. You can be very wealthy and be a complete slob, like Trimalchio in this piece. And his name shows up right there twice, so I don't know why you can misspell it, but a lot of people did. Okay. Any question on that? The fourth answer was a passage from the Confessions by St. Augustine, where he talks about his life as a troublemaker as a boy before he found God. And one of the weird things he did was he stole pears even when he didn't want them. And as he thought back later, he figured that he did it just because he wanted to do something bad. His explanation for that desire was he was really desiring God, but he didn't know in what direction to turn his longing. So he turned to theft instead. And later, once he got religion, then he had a proper sense of right and wrong, and he was able to look back and realize that his behavior was bad. If you want to get more complicated about it, you could also say that he also realized that his behavior was fairly normal. Right? That deep part of Christianity, which is this constantly forgiving of sins. Right? So just because he stole the pears didn't make him unfit to convert later on. He wasn't ruled out, right? Not that it would have been better not to do that, but it didn't disqualify him for religious life. The fifth passage is this, the Beatitudes, which you didn't need to use that word, from the Sermon on the Mount by Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. And the fascinating thing about these statements is that, and again, I held this up as I wasn't sure about this, but it just seemed to me that it's one of the first times we see an inordinate concern for the poor anywhere. And here the point of these Beatitudes is not that you're supposed to be poor, but that even if you are poor, you're still eligible for the kingdom of heaven. Right? This is not the same thing as the later Protestant work ethic. It's not a very Calvinist notion, where certainly a lot of the Protestants who came to America deeply believe that the measure of their ability to get it, they could weigh whether they would get into heaven by how much money they made. The Protestant work ethic. You read the letters of some of the early settlers in Indianapolis. They're all over this. You've got to be rich, and actually getting wealthy shows that God's on your side. A lot of people believe that. The President of the United States believes that, I can guarantee you. But this is not what this is about. This is just the opposite. That's why you got to have tax cuts, make sure everybody's wealthy so they can all get into heaven. But that doesn't seem to be what's being said here. Here, poverty is no disqualification, and in fact may be a qualification if you read the rest of it, because when you have wealth, you run into all sorts of other sins. Pride, arrogance, you're more likely to louse up if you have money. So it's a really fascinating conception. Six was pretty hard, I think. This is the questioning of Jesus before the crucifixion, where he's being asked if he said he was the king of the Jews, and he's being asked about other statements he'd been made, including having said that he would tear down the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. And I really, this might be the only unfair one on the question, but most people got it that he's speaking metaphorically, and the temple of God refers to his body, and that when he dies, in other words, when the temple is destroyed, he'll in 3 days rebuild it, the time between this Friday, this week, and Sunday. In other words, between the crucifixion on Friday and the resurrection on Easter. So he's speaking metaphorically. Okay. Anyway, I think I gave a lot of points are getting close. Number seven is from the Quran, and it's a very difficult passage to swallow. It says if your wife is giving you trouble, just beat her up. Okay, and you've got the authority of God to do it. And I give you an email saying this was practically saying this is going to be on the exam, and I'd say half the class looked up the New York Times article and realized that this has been a problem passage, and a scholar is arguing that the Arabic for beat them up doesn't really mean beat them up, it means something else. That's not quite as violent. All right. What I would like to have had you do is talk about the issue of being when you see bad behavior, even in religious texts, as a good person, you don't follow it. Okay, you realize it must be metaphorical. Okay, it would take a bad person, I think, to read this and say, "Oh my God, I didn't know that. I'm going home right today and whack," and she better like it, right? Because it says so right here. Come on, Lou, God, it says so right here, right? So a good person wouldn't do that. The larger issue is that all religions have these things, that the prescriptions for the religion, for what's considered a good life, change, and they change over time because society changes, right? And also because if you think about it, one way of thinking about it, the nature of God really isn't whatever's going on there in that Platonic other world. It's pretty mysterious. And it takes a lot of nerve to think that you're reading the message correctly that's coming out of there, right? That it's saying, do X, Y, and Z, right? And these days, the hot button issues, are abortion and gay marriage, but that's just these days. These things will disappear, and there'll be other things coming up. Intermarriage, what language should you speak? Should I eat leavened bread on Passover? Something really important like that. Okay. How many Christmas presents do I give? Should I give them at all? Right. I mean, people will search the sacred texts for these things, but it's because we all want guidance, but it's not necessarily clear that specific ethical prescriptions can be found in any sacred text. In other words, you can believe in God, and you could, and therefore that could make you believe in good and evil. But what is good and evil becomes problematic right away, because there's not a list of 456 things that are good and 782 things that are bad, all right, that we can all agree on, right? In some societies, this maybe this was good for women to get beaten up, okay? But because, you know, if you went out, you got raped, all right? It was worse, you know, here's why they should stay home, because believe me, you don't understand, but if you walk down the street, it's all over. So I don't know what the conditions are, but clearly they should change, and there's got to be some flexibility. There's plenty in any religion that requires that. Number 8 was from Beowulf. The hard times were there because Grendel was killing people, reaching into the old mead hall and slaying Hrothgar's men. People didn't know what to do with this evil attacking them, so they prayed to their gods, which were pagan shrines. Okay, they thought it was the wrath of God sending Grendel. It's exactly like what we see in Boccaccio's Decameron. When the plague comes down in Florence, people say, must be the wrath of God. Couldn't possibly be those bacteria living on the rats, okay, that they didn't know about. Or, like in the 80s, even President Reagan said, well, AIDS, well, that's the wrath of God because you're engaging in homosexual behavior. Well, it's not. It's a virus. It's got nothing to do with God, right? Because right now, AIDS is a huge scourge in Africa, and it's not a homosexual disease. It's a heterosexual disease. So it's got nothing to do with, it's not that it's unrelated to it, that you don't have to have sex, but it's not because of the sex. So here we have the same problem, and what's so fascinating about this is that the poet looks back on these Geats, they were called G-E-A-T-S, or these old English people would be enough, and the poet is writing from the stance of someone who believes in a single Christian God, and he's writing a story about people who don't know God yet, okay? So he's very distant, and he can look at their behavior with detachment. Number 9 is from the story of the Grail by Chrétien de Troyes, and it depicts Percival. Percival. A lot of people couldn't remember his name. This is one of the mysterious things he witnesses, where he does not, having been instructed not to ask too many questions, he doesn't question the meaning of what he sees. And it turns out that his instruction was faulty, that he should have asked what these things mean. So he's got contradictory advice. So he's a lost soul, and he goes off to sort of find the truth, and the story is unfinished, but it seems to be some kind of story of education, and one we can all respond to, because none of us really knows what's going on. We get contradictory advice from different people. I always tell my son, he wants to go to Zimbabwe, which is the most dangerous place on earth right now. They're beating up the political opposition in the streets. I get an email, he's going to Zimbabwe during his junior year abroad. I said, don't go, join the Marines. You know? He says, the Marines, Dad? You know? So, contradictory advice right there. He thinks he should go there to learn about Zimbabwe. I'm telling him another thing. Should we join the army, people? You know, this contradictory advice. Pretty remarkable problem today. But I told him, you know, you go in there, you get out, you can run for Congress. You're a vet. You get taken care of for the rest of your life. Right? Yeah, it's a good deal. Not that I did it, but. Number 10. This is from Dante's Inferno, Canto 5. It's the story of Francesca telling how she had a love affair with Paolo and how they were killed for it. At this point, she's saying how they first began the affair. They were reading the story of Lancelot and Guinevere, and they read the part where Galahalt brought Lancelot into the presence of the queen and arranged things so that the queen managed to get Lancelot to kiss her. So Galahalt promoted the sex between Lancelot and Guinevere. So Galahalt is a term they use in Italian for a go-between or a pimp. Okay? So the book that they read served the same function for them, Paolo and Francesca, in other words, brought them together, as Galahalt served for Guinevere and Lancelot. And we'll go back today to remember the same function that Boccaccio hopes his book serves for lots of you out there. Okay, that you can, and we'll read some of those stories, see if it works. And the essay, I don't know what to say. It's a 3. It was, again, if you got -3, that was the normal. -4 meant I could add a little bit more, and -2 was better than average. And if you got all the points, you were good. And if you missed a lot more than that, I don't know. Now, you had half the number of questions as the last exam, so I know it's a lot of writing, but I think it's just because you're not used to writing, right? So any questions on this? Right. For those of you who really messed up and are having trouble, you probably ought to, and been coming here, you better see me or you better start writing or listening to the tapes. I don't know. So let's take, what I want to do is go back and just make sure you got this Boccaccio thing down, right? So let's take a look at a story. And this is page 16, that made a number of points before. This is the first work really written for women. Okay. The women come across as very smart speakers. It's clearly asking for people to behave in a new way, and it uses the story of the plague in order to argue that social customs need to be reformed and people need to basically lighten up. And your behavior can change. And in fact, Boccaccio says behavior did change. For example, in a passage I didn't do last time, at the top of page 1606, during the plague, people, they had these big egg-shaped bulbos, they were called, black things. That's how the plague affected you. And top of 1606, and the women would take their clothes off to try and get help, right? And he says that in Italy, obviously, women had never exposed themselves in mixed company, but now it became kind of normal because everybody's so sick. So he said that led to a breakdown in modesty, right? And people saw that you could, you know, just because your body was seen and wasn't the end of the world, and sort of the habit sort of hung in there, and people were less straight-laced about how they dressed. There's an interesting argument on 1605 too that, and this is about at the end of the third to the last paragraph, how even family members wouldn't help other family members when they were sick because people were so afraid of catching the plague. And the argument seems to be that there was a real lack of love, where love should be during a time of stress, it disappeared. So the argument is there's a need for love. Right? We can all sort of get in behind that. But Boccaccio is clearly pushing it I mean, lots of love. Not just little family love, but, you know, let's make love, not war kind of love, right, which is what he's arguing for. All right, so we're up to, I talked about the whole plague is a, let me repeat my point. This is the main one. In the earlier books, the confrontation with death gave you a new sense of right and wrong and moved you to a belief in God. Here, the confrontation with death in the form of the plague moves you to a new sense of right and wrong. But the purpose isn't to get you towards God. It's to get you to rethink what's right and what's wrong, particularly in the sexual arena. Okay? So it's a bit of a parody of the early literature. And Boccaccio's clearly sort of had Dante up to here and wants to lighten up. And that's what he does. And that's why he's generally considered the first modern writer. We begin, you know, we had the second term of the course was the Middle Ages, or the medieval period. With Boccaccio, we're in the Renaissance. And that's the rest of the course. The Renaissance is kind of the beginning of the modern world where people, the traditional view is people are individuals, they think more, they read the classics, there's a renewal of art, and you're not bound in a hierarchical world, but we tend to, for the first time, really think for yourself. And the great exponent of this individual thought is Montaigne, who you get to next Thursday. So he's like the big goal we're aiming at, is Montaigne and his essays. But before we get there, we have to have some Rabelais. Well, I thought we'd, since I'm just lecturing so much, why don't we just read a story? This will get you to participate. And see what we can do with it. Let's take a short one first and then see how that goes. So let's just go to... page 1624. And I'm going to just go around the room and let you read it out loud. This way you get to participate a bit. All right? Now, one of the ways, and we haven't really talked about this because I haven't been doing this as a literature course. I've been doing it sort of more of a cultural course. But if you get a short story in this class or any other, and you're asked to analyze it, I never know what to do. So what I like to do is you just ask, what happened? And by what happened, and I don't have an answer yet. I haven't prepped this one, but I'm sure I can go back and do it. Something big happens. Somebody makes a decision somewhere in the work of art, and he or she does something based on that decision, okay? Should I kill my father and sleep with my mother or not? Well, Oedipus never actually makes that decision, does he? Okay. But that would have been a heck of a decision to make. Okay, we could have. So in that being a very complicated example, since he didn't, what he did decide to do was run away from home to escape his fate. Okay, that was his decision. Or he pursued Tiresias. He insisted on going through with his investigation into the cause of the plague. I mean, he really does something. Or when he puts out his eyes, I mean, he said, well, you know, should I put out my eyes or not? Yep, I think I will. That's what I call doing something. Okay? At some point, he had to make that decision. So as we go through here, maybe we'll try and find out what's going on. And the pronunciation guide for this is on page 1600. And I think we need to know how to say Guillaume de Cabestan and Guillaume de Roussillon. Roussillon? Guillaume means William in French, right? So, and the place this takes place is Provence, and the people who live there are the Provençals. So have you read, did you read this? Anybody? All right, so this is a good time. Why don't you just start off and read a few lines, and I'll move up the aisle and wind around the class. Yeah. All right, just look on with your neighbor. Okay. So, do you have another book back there? You have one? You don't have one. Well, get up there with Dawn and look at her book. Okay. And, is anybody within, you know, range of a book? Okay. All right. Go ahead, Tom. Yes, the Provençals. De Roussillon. De Capaston. Ah, very good. Très bien. Now, what do you think jousts and tournaments are? Yeah, horsemen. This is a very medieval time, right? You get on the horse and you have this big lance, right? And these guys used to do it for fun, right? For fun. So, do you think they're poor boys or rich? They must be rich, because you got to afford a horse, you have to afford the armor, you have to have a squire. It costs a lot of money. But they had clearly leisure time, right? Aaron, go ahead. Thank you very much. Whoa, what? What happened? Just read that again. I can't believe what I'm reading. I can't believe what I'm reading. This is a Purdue class. Now you gotta say that Boccaccio does not waste any time, right? She began to notice him, and by the end of the sentence, they made love several times. Okay, why shouldn't Guillaume de Cabestan be messing around with this woman? Because she's married. But what are the other reasons? They're right here. Yeah, it's his best friend. Okay. Not only is she married, right? But it seems almost more important that he's you know, screwing his friend. I don't know how else to put it, okay? And, you know, violating this bond of brotherhood, right? And how do you think he managed, what do you think the various subtle ways he used were to bring his love to his lady's notice? Do you have any any email, text message? Pretty hard, huh? A lot of glances, I think. Right? At the right time. Oh, well, we're not told, right? This is not a manual on how to, is it? Okay, we're getting right to the consequences. So go ahead, Dawn. Okay, so what did he do? What did Guillaume de Roussillon do? What did he do? What did he do here? What's the moral action? He's furious. What? He decided to kill his friend, right? Now, in my analysis, I'm not going to go into this class, decisions don't count. You have to do something. See, but I can't, like, read your mind. Just because you decide to do something, if you haven't done it, it's not an action, is it? It's not really palpable, Eh? What did he do in this paragraph? He made the resolution, so you could say that. You could make it a verbal act. He resolved, right? But he then did something. He pretended he still loved his wife, but does it actually say that? That's a consequence of what he actually does. You're right. You're on the right track. He concealed it. He hid it. Anybody watching The Sopranos? What country is this written for? Where does this take place? What country? Italy. You know, right? He vows revenge. Why didn't he just go out and kill the guy? Because revenge tastes best cold. Right? You know that? You ever heard that phrase? Yeah, you wanna get the right revenge. It's got to be the just revenge. That's the artistic problem here. And there's something, we're in an artistic society. Okay? Hamlet's got the same thing. We're not doing Hamlet. But, you know, he just doesn't want to kill his uncle. He kind of wants to do it right. Right? So he wants to find out all the facts. He never quite does it. But that's sort of what's bothering him. He wants the proper revenge. You want to hear my revenge story? Go rent a movie called Mimi Metallurgica. By Nina Wertmüller, great Italian director. There's a guy named Mimi who's from Sicily, and he takes a job at the Fiat factory making cars in Torino, Italy, which is up in the north. He leaves his wife behind in Sicily. So while he's freezing up there in northern Italy, his wife's back down in Sicily, and she has an affair with the mayor of the town. So Mimi comes home on a vacation, finds out his wife's having an affair, yells, "Vendetta!" Right? Which is Italian for revenge. What is he going to do? Well, he beats his wife up for a while. But then he's got to get the revenge on the mayor. You see, but he thinks it's got to be artistic. You can't just kill the guy. That's too blunt. So he comes up with the right, he's got to, you know, quid pro quo. He's got to seduce the mayor's wife. Eh? That's the proper revenge. The problem is, Mimi is played by this Italian actor named Giancarlo Giannini, who's one of the great, handsome Italian actors of the 20th century, right? And the wife of the mayor weighs about 400 pounds. So he shows up at her doorstep with the red roses, you know? She's sitting there with all... and he starts to dance with her. Okay, so trying to get the right revenge, right? So here we go. He conceals... What he does here is he conceals his revenge. So go ahead, David. You're carry us on. Okay, so he actually pretty quickly murders the guy, doesn't he? So the concealment, this story doesn't seem to be being that important. What he does is he just kills the guy. Okay, he chooses the right spot, I guess. But I'm a little, you know, I'm not getting a story yet. The story really, it doesn't seem to be to the heart of it. But we see Boccaccio moving really quickly. He's such a brilliant narrator here. So go ahead, Colin. Okay, does this add anything to the story? You know, artistic analysis, everything's related. I don't know. I mean, the men just run off, okay? The friendship maybe was a theme earlier. Here these guys know that this is not the time to, you know, swear devotion when you've been ambushed. You just, you know, because you don't know what else is in the woods. So they just get out of town, right? So, go ahead. You are Amanda. Okay, so this guy's done a number of things. He concealed his plan, he ambushed the guy, he killed him, and what did he do here? What did he do? He didn't just think about it, he did something. He tore the guy's heart out of his chest, right? Yeah? Like a trophy? Yeah, we don't know yet, but we know he's grabbed it. He's gonna, you figure he's gonna do something, you know, trophy, why else would he tear the heart out of the guy? Yeah, he will, in fact, give it to his wife. Okay, good. But, you know, is there anything symbolic about the heart? Right? There were other parts of the guy he could have... Yeah, it seems to be related to love. It seems to be the right organ, so to speak, to take out the guy. Although, who knows? Could have cut his ears off. Name? Lori, yeah, go ahead. Cole. What did he just do? He lied, all right? This guy's doing a lot of stuff, isn't he? I mean, it's really, really interesting. All right, go ahead. Roussillon left her standing there. Okay, so what does he do? He lies to the cook. He seems to trust the cook to make a really fine dish out of it. By the way, do you like heart for dinner? Yeah. You ever have it? You ever have heart? I had it once in Italy. Not my favorite. But it's what the cowboys ate on the trail. You know, they didn't give them steak out there. They got the heart. Right? So if you read cowboy narrative. Some people do eat hearts. It's not like totally. That's not the weird part of the story. Okay. Go ahead. But what? Yeah. Renee. All right. Now, wait a minute. What was going on with this guy? What? He felt bad. He couldn't eat because he felt bad. That seems a little weird, doesn't it? I think he's not eating because he don't want to eat that. Right? So there's two kind of contradictory things going on. I'd almost have to look at the Italian to see how badly the guy felt. Yeah. Oh, I see. Right. So the heart wasn't in there yet. You're right. Good point. But he's feeling the reaction here. Okay. Yeah. He says though he's unable to eat, like, and, you know, because he's emotionally distraught. But you're right, there's a difference between the narrator's view of the terrible deed and what we wonder is going through the mind of this guy. Unless the narrator tells us what Guillaume de Roussillon is thinking, we don't know. Well, he's nervous. He's doing a revenge. You know, the revenge is... But the point of the Sopranos, you see, is Tony Soprano, he kills, he whacks a guy, but then he has to go to the psychiatrist, right? You don't have to watch it because he gets guilt feelings. I mean, he has to do horrible things, but he's all convoluted and full of emotion. So it's very interesting, very modern view of a guy in the middle of a revenge. I mean, he does what he has to do. He's incredibly clever, and he's active, but he's not without emotions, not without emotional thought. And we'll see if that comes up again. Go ahead, Jeremiah. Now, what did he just do? Right? Confessed fully? Yeah, he's still hiding things, isn't he? He's confronting her. He's making her realize what's going on. That's why you want the cold revenge, so that the other person knows they've been hit. All right, you just don't want to. But he doesn't tell her openly, right? He's making a little riddle, so she's got to figure out. So he's kind of riddling, right? Now we've seen lots of riddles before in this class. You know, seven lean cows and seven. This one's a little different. Okay, being used to torture you, but maybe there's a connection. So who's behind? I can't even see. Guillaume de Cabestan. Go ahead, in the back. You don't have it? Well, get near one. Isn't there one here? Guillaume de Cabestan. What? What did she say? He says to her, what does he say? He says, "You faithless woman, that was the heart of Guillaume de Cabestan." And she says, "This can only be the work of an evil and treacherous knight." Who is the evil and treacherous knight? He is. By the way, why did she have an affair with this guy, with Guillaume de Cabestan? What? Because he was virtuous. Husband doesn't come into it? Yeah, I don't say what's wrong. Any guesses? Now that we've seen him in action? He lies, he conceals, he riddles. All right? He's a coward. She hates the guy. Right? This is written for a female audience. You don't have to explain it to women. They know their husbands are rats. They don't have to... And don't forget, this is being spoken by a guy named Dionysius, all right, who is making the little editorial comments. We have a narrator in the story, all right? But I think this hardly requires explanation. And she, now what does the wife do? See, what does she do? Yeah, she calls him out, right? She says, "You're a jerk." She didn't go, oh, I'm so sorry. No, I didn't do anything. What? She said, well, I kind of like that heart. You know? I guess I deserved it. No, she just like, you know, is she brave, bold, foolish? Must be pretty brave. I mean, the guy's just killed her lover. And this is Italy. I think she knows that this is, that she's next on the list. Okay. Or she suspects it. All right. So where are we? Right in the front here for the 800th time this semester. What? Tabitha, yeah. What? It's like that Woody Allen line when he's in, I think it's the Broadway Danny Rose, and he's with Mia Farrow, and she's married to a mobster. And she says, yeah, my first husband, my new husband killed my first husband, shot him in the eyes. And Woody Allen, like only Woody Allen goes, you mean he went blind? She goes, no, he died. Well, here she dies, but she's also disfigured. Okay, I think I can attribute that to the narrator, okay, who's the kind of weird guy that might be more important. So what does the woman do? Now, is that an action? Is that a moral action, do you think? Did she weigh the consequences and then take action? Was she an agent, as we like to say in women's studies today? Was she a thinking, acting woman, or was she just a mere pawn being pushed around by the superior forces of a patriarchal society? First one. Well, I mean, it's actually an argument because she jumps right out of the window without thinking, it says. Right. Did she? Yeah, but in fact, the story suggests otherwise. She has time to make her decision. So she decides, what is she doing? When you are hurt, you get when Guillaume de Roussillon is hurt, he gets revenge. When his wife is hurt, what does she do? She gets, you know, you could argue she gets revenge. Now, why doesn't she kill him? Well, because you know, it's just a woman, she doesn't have the power. So you could argue that this is her revenge. Right? It's not me to push around anymore. Right? She gets revenge in her own way, the way the powerless have. All right, go ahead, Katie. What did the guy do at the end? He ran away. Why? Isn't he a man? Isn't he allowed to beat up his wife? Isn't he allowed to get his revenge? What? He was ashamed of what? Is that what you said? He's ashamed? Something happened. That death was significant, wasn't it? Because it had a consequence. Okay? So she did something to him. She got her revenge, and you know, by killing herself, she made it impossible for him to stay in town. Now why would that be? Yeah. This was her castle? Oh, okay. Okay. She was popular with the local people. Do you think he was very popular? You know. I mean, that guy is very clever and devious and gets his revenge and everything, but she didn't, you know, she did have an affair with her husband, so he wasn't Mr. Wonderful. Okay? And he's scared at the end, so he doesn't have a popular base. Right? This would be a nice comparison to Hamlet, because Hamlet's always got the people's favor, where his nasty uncle doesn't. But then they build this single tomb. Why do they put the lover and the wife and the woman in a tomb? Isn't that like condoning adultery? Yeah. True love. So romantic. Okay. Doesn't this happen to Romeo and Juliet too? Don't they get a single tomb at the end? I mean, they both kill themselves, but the families reconcile by putting him in a tomb, and somehow love conquers all here. Right? So we have a poor woman in a disastrous position doing what she can do. Why don't you... I wasn't going to do the Canterbury Tales, but maybe I won't, but I really think you should read... be sure you don't want to read all these stories, but read the sixth story of the ninth day, which is on page 1631. This is sort of called a fabliau. I don't have time to do it right now. And then you might want to, a very standard thing is compare it to one of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, which is The Miller's Tale, which is on page 1718. Why don't we just sort of tuck that in? And I don't know if I need to read it line for line, but we can talk about it for a few minutes on next Tuesday. I'm trying to pick out stuff that you actually like. I mean, I just didn't find anything in the Arabian Nights, and but these things are sort of no-miss stories. If you don't like these, I'll shoot myself. I'll throw myself out the window. Okay. Well, you can have 5 minutes early for this, since we finish the story. No, the Miller's Tale on page... Read, let me write it on the board then. Now, I'd like you to read them, but can I examine them? I don't know. Read the Boccaccio. Report back to me. I mean, you're supposed to read all this stuff, all right? But right now, I'm canceling today's assignment, and I'm adding The Miller's Tale, all right? But we'll still go on to Rabelais, and I'll try to get to Rabelais next Tuesday. Okay? You need the page number for this? I just lost it. What? 1718? So you want to compare Miller's Tale to Boccaccio. Excuse me? Mimi Metallurgico, Mimi the Metallurgist. I don't know. I think it's the 1970. Okay, Lena Wertmüller is the director. Mimi Metallurgico. I know there's a dub version of it, or subtitles. It's a great movie. Great movie. So you want to?
I completely forgot my question, so I'll
let you go. Okay.
I put the wrong answer for that one.
I didn't. Well, I'm gonna change the grade. Okay. Even the monkey sometimes falls out of the tree. Good to see you back on the.
I was wondering. Yeah. I got marked off for that one.
Which one?
Plato. And there's two more. And the essay. You guys got a lot of minus ones.
You got a lot of minus ones?
Yeah.
Oh, so you... Well, you'd have to get... You'd have to get 7 of these in order to get up to the next level.
I know. So is that one?
That one's cool. Losing the big points is tough.
That one?
Well, I mean, P is like, you know...
P?
Yeah, Petronius.
He probably went by P.
So, you know, that's a point.
Okay. And those ones I understand.
Okay.
That one I understand. This one I don't.
Well, besides spelling, Chrétien, I was really wrong. But you know, you didn't mention the Grail or Percival.
I mentioned the Grail.
You did?
Okay.
No questions were asked. You know that we discussed passive verbs because Percival did not ask any questions, right?
Okay. And then
yeah, that's two.
I got a minus one.
Well, that's pretty good.
Well, I know, but there's like good comments around minus one.
Well, and because again, it's like wrestling. You start with minus three.
Wrestling's
great. I know. You start with minus three, and then when you do better than that, right? So it's not like, you know, there's room for perfection. Okay, you could have brought in four more examples and stuff like that. It's only a point.
It is only a point.
Right. It's the 4 points on the Dante that killed you. What the heck am I doing? Oh, yeah, all right. Definitely. Oh, that's big for you.
Yeah.
That's big. All right. That's all I need. That's huge. Talk about borderline. You can go home and breathe.
And I was wondering why I got one off on this one.
Dante. You didn't tell me it was Dante.
Well, I thought that was kind of an obvious thing.
Well, you know. Nothing too obvious on these exams. It won't change anything now. All right, you guys are all in the same boat, you three, right? So you all got the same problem. But you're always in class. You're always, generally always in class. Pretty much. But you're having trouble with my exams, right?
The first one did all right.
But yeah, the first one I did okay.
Yeah. How'd you do on the first one? Let's see, all right. But you both, you all messed up bad. Okay. What? You mean you just didn't, did you study hard or did you just blow it off? You did?
Yeah, I did.